Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
I think leopards are probably one of the most successful predators on Earth.
Yes, they're very opportunistic and they can adapt easily. And
what can they teach us?
We've seen a relationship of leopards and humans. And whether it's in art or mythology, folklore, just storytelling, everywhere across Asia and Africa.
Many species are in crisis and need your help.
If you're fortunate to see them in zoos, but that's the Amur leopard, and this is the one that's the most endangered of any leopard species. So far eastern Russia, north.
Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Angie.
How you doing, Angie?
I'm excellent. How are you?
Dude, this weather is awesome in Florida. Right now it's fall.
Very much so, yeah. With a little bit of color change.
A little bit of color change, and it's actually a little bit cooler for once in late October.
Walking the dog this morning was amazing.
Yeah, and then, of course, next week we'll probably be like 90 again, and we'll be sweaty and hot, typical Florida weather. This week we're talking about leopards, and I know you and I both have investigated, you know, what we can about these animals, and it's been a fun week for me, especially going back and forth with my wife, who used to take care of some of these animals at the zoo.
And that's interesting, Chris, because I was going back and forth with my husband, John, who was a carnivore keeper.
Right.
And worked with carnivores a lot at the zoo, and I pride myself on being a hoof and horns type lady.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot about these guys and have, not that I didn't have respect for them before, but I now want to go take care of them or learn more about them
or
see them in the wild. Yeah, they're quite beautiful animals, and I've been blessed enough to go to Africa twice and been on a couple different safaris in Tanzania and in Zambia. And I've seen four of the big five, but that leopard's
tough to see.
Is so elusive.
They are.
So, yeah, they're still a mystery to me, but I got to learn a lot about them. And now I really want to get back to Africa and
try to find one.
Sure.
They are elusive cats. And it's really interesting. Growing up, you know, I haven't seen a lot of leopards at zoos, and maybe they're not as charismatic. You know, we use that term a lot.
Everybody thinks lion or tiger.
Or jags. Mm-hmm. You know, you even see jaguars because they're a little bit bigger than I've seen than leopards. But I remember the first time I saw a leopard and I was like, man, they're kind of small because on the TV, you know, they look big and they're not as big, I guess, as I thought they were. They're still pretty big cats, but not huge like a lion.
Right. They don't have that super impressive size you're going to see with a tiger.
Right. Right. And I thought a leopard would be like a smaller tiger, but it's actually not. It's actually a little bit smaller than that, but still big, successful cats. And I think, in my opinion, next to domestic cats, because we'll get into that in this podcast, I think leopards are probably one of the most successful predators on Earth.
Yes, they're very opportunistic and they can adapt easily, and their prey can range anything from crabs to baby giraffes.
Yeah, baby giraffes. We'll get into that in what they like to eat. The leopards belong to what we call felids, and that's a term that kind of applies, or feline, applies to all cats. And there's generally eight big groups of cats. And the leopards belong to the big group, the big cats, where you have the lions, tigers, jags, leopards, and then the different types of leopards. There's the general leopard, which we're going to really get into today, really focus on. Then there's separate species of snow leopard, which are a little distant related to the leopard, and then clouded leopard, which is completely different species. The lineages of cats, I think, is good to go over in this podcast, because I guarantee you we're going to talk about lions at some point, I hope.
Oh, we'll talk about lions.
I love lions. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I was like 2 feet away from a male lion, Leroy, at a rescue zoo, and his head was huge.
Did he have a full mane?
No, actually, he was castrated, which means he doesn't have his nuts.
His testosterone.
You know, right, testosterone source. So he lost his mane, but I'm not kidding you, his head was enormous. It was like at least, I would say, 4 feet wide.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I was like, holy smokes.
Big boys, for sure.
They are, and his paws, like, impressive. Just as big as my chest. It was huge. They very, very impressive. So, yeah, we're going to talk about other cats eventually.
Well, and if you can't relate to necessarily a lion encounter, you can probably relate to your own kitty at home.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Because I have two little lions at home myself.
Yeah. I've got two outside that were screaming at me this morning for forgetting to feed them. So when I drove up, they both ran out to my car like dogs. So I think going over cat evolution quickly. We'll make it understand. And then in future podcasts, we can just refer back to, hey, if you want to know more, listen to the beginning part of the leopard podcast. They can trace cat evolution to one particular species of modern felids or modern cats. And that's this cat called Pseudaelurus.
That's one of your better ones.
Don't ask me to say it. I could say cat, dog, the boy, girl.
And I won't ask you to say it again.
Either. Yeah. No. Okay. Pseudaelurus.
Very good.
Okay. This thing lived between 9 to 20 million years ago in Asia, and probably like the size of a current leopard, actually. Not really huge, but not small. And this is the modern distant relative of modern cats. Now, there are other lineages of cats that have died out. I think the saber-toothed cat is probably the most popular ancient cat. They actually had relatives that dated back like 35, 40 million years ago we saw the rise of a lot of mammals. Right. When we talk, and it seems like, what are we on, episode 5, 6 now? It seems with each mammal, elephants, rhinos, other things we talk about, around 40 to 50 million years ago is when we had this huge explosion of mammals. Right. After the last fifth mass extinction when dinosaurs finally went out. So that's the one we can trace back to now with them. And then they have some really cool relatives that went extinct. So I just related to leopards, lions, and everything. And one of them I read about was called the giant cheetah. And they're about the size of a modern lion.
Oh, wow.
Could you imagine that thing chasing you down as fast as they are? They think the giant cheetah is not quite as fast.
Maybe because of its size.
Right, a little bit bigger, but probably pretty fast.
It can outrun you.
Yes, that's a giant cheetah. And again, luckily we've dealt with some cheetahs or been seeing cheetahs at the conservation center we work with here in Florida, where they're actually the number one cheetah breeder in the world. And they have like 35 to 40 breeding pairs?
They have a large amount, and they have a very good, successful regimen that they do, because cheetahs can be very hard to breed in a captive setting.
Yeah. Yeah, and inbred, right? They're also very highly inbred because of the problems with them. There's nothing cuter on earth than a baby cheetah. I know baby animals are adorable.
I don't know. I agree halfway. I think a baby clouded leopard.
Okay. Well, a baby cat, maybe as a kitten. Yeah. I mean, puppies are awesome too, and you love puppies and baby wolves, but those baby cheetahs with that crazy hair.
Yeah, they do have wild Einstein hair.
Right. And, when we were going around on that private tour that one time, and we saw the litter of like 8.
Yeah, and the noises they make too are just melt your heart.
Yeah, cheetahs are just, they're amazing. Anyways, the giant cheetah, thankfully for us, went extinct about 10,000 years ago, and they lived in Europe and Asia. And so they were a distant relative. And then like some of the other cats, there was a giant jaguar. Again, the size of a modern lion or tiger, lived in North and South America. They went extinct about 11,000 years ago. One of the more popular ones that people probably could relate to or have heard about is the cave lion in Europe. And this lived in Europe, Asia, and North America.
Is it like a mountain lion?
No, it's like a modern
lion.
African lion. Right. Wow. These things were huge. They were actually bigger than typical lions today, up to 800-900 pounds. It's a small horse. Size, big, strong. The cave paintings that we kind of referred to a couple episodes ago with the rhinos, they have cave paintings of these cave lions in Europe. So, where there wasn't, not African lions, but these cave lions. And so they went extinct during the last ice age too, around 11,000 years ago. The one that I found, this one was probably the coolest, and it is Macher otis. Okay, that's a big word.
Yeah, you did a nice job on that.
I'm breaking these
pretty
down.
Good for a Friday.
Yeah. Macher otis caber is the name of this cat. It was the size of a horse, and it was like a saber-toothed cat.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I wouldn't want to come across that.
Yeah. Could you imagine walking by like our window right now and like the shoulder, I'm staring at the shoulder
How
of this
big
cat.
Would its mouth and head be?
Oh, it's as big as this table. I don't know. It's huge.
Wow.
So this is, they have had... found lots of fossil evidence of this cat. So very, very big. Lived in Europe, Asia, Africa, North America. Again, that frozen period, ice age period, where you had the land bridge. So these animals were able to migrate and follow herds and things. Luckily, specifically luckily for us, they died out about 5 million years ago. So long gone. The saber-toothed cat was more, smaller. Kind of like a jaguar size.
Is that the Smilodon?
Yeah. Or you say it.
Cimlodon.
Yeah, that one. Okay.
I might have made that up, but that's how I pronounce it to my 4-year-old when we read Ice Age mammal books that he's madly in love with.
That one, that's what people think about. Those are much smaller.
Well, and that's why I was surprised to hear about this big one, this giant horse-like saber-tooth one you were talking about, because the Ice Age, at least books for kids and whatnot, always bring up the Cimlodon.
Right. And yeah, I mean, think about the Ice Age 10,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. This was 5 million years ago, so long time ago when these guys existed. And they're long gone. Long gone. Just huge, huge cats. Now,
but so cool.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome. Like, that's why this evolution stuff's fun to talk about, because you think about the history. I guess when it gets to the conservation part, too, not, you know, like last podcast you were talking about being doom and gloom, and I don't want to be all doom and gloom.
No, that's not why we're here.
Yeah, no, we want to, you know, spread knowledge. But it makes you so sad when you think it took 40, 50 million years to make this animal to get to this point, and then, bam, they're gone.
In a matter of a couple hundred years. Yeah, they're basically the industrial and technology age.
It's just done. They're done. Yeah, that's sad. That makes me sad. Anyway,
we're not going to let that happen.
Yeah, no, that's why we're fighting.
Or at least we're going to try to not let that happen.
Now, back to our favorite mitochondrial DNA analysis.
All right, wake me up when it's over.
No, that's all I'm saying about it.
Remember, it is Friday, my brain is on Friday mode.
We have used that to look at these lineages of cats. Okay, so that's why we kind of talked about it with the elephants, that it's a powerful tool, a genetic tool that we can look at different lines. So cats today are you know, like I said, they're broken out in these 8 families, but 37 distinct species. And of course, there's always subspecies within a major species. But the 8 lineages of cats, the big one's Panthera, and that's the one we're going to talk about today.
And that's what leopard falls under.
Right. You have the leopard, the snow leopard, the clouded leopard, all 3 separate species, tiger, lion, and jaguar. And puma, right? Cougar. So they fall into that. The other lineages, there's the bay cat, which, you know, is a separate species in Southeast Asia. The caracal. We know about the caracal. So that's a separate species of African.
Much smaller, big ears. Mm-hmm. I believe I did see a caracal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In Tanzania.
Oh, you did? Oh, out in the wild. Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you think about how they survive again. Oh, it's just crazy. Anyways, that's not what this show's about. It's leopards. Same thing. Ocelot. So south and central. Used to be in North America, but no longer. They're no longer up here. The lynx, which is what we always forget about.
That's a North American.
Right. We should probably do an episode on lynx, because I don't know a lot about them, and probably people don't. We don't even think about it.
Well, I think, once again, they're very elusive, mm-hmm. and, you know, you don't really hear much about them.
Right. But except the coats, right?
Or the bobcat, too.
Yeah, the bobcat. The puma, right? We talked about that. The Asian leopard cat, and then our favorite domestic cat. You know, its own little lineages, a little turds. Gotta love them, though.
Turds that we love. I love them. They don't love us back.
They don't. They're so smart. They're the smartest predator on Earth.
And they laugh about it.
Yeah. I mean, we feed them. We give them water every day. And then they just... anyways, little turds. We love them. So, Angie, what's really interesting about this Panthera family of big cats is that all of them can roar except the clouded leopard.
Well, what vocalization does the clouded leopard make?
I think it's called chuffing.
Ah, tigers also chuff when they like you.
I've heard some tiger sounds. They're amazing when you're up close to them.
Would you like to hear my demonstration?
Please do.
That I do for Xander. And I learned it from my husband, too, just so you know. These are things we practice at home.
Yes, with kids.
Okay. So I don't know if this definitely represents a clouded leopard or a regular leopard, but it definitely will represent a...
A tiger. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hear it.
Don't make me laugh.
I don't even want to know whenever you make those sounds. Oh, yeah. You're lying about your kids.
Okay, I'm trying one more time. So here's my best attempt. Don't make me laugh. And the even funnier thing is my son, Xander, who had to grow up with 2 animal lovers, most kids would say, oh, a tiger or, you know, a lion roars. Right. No. No, he knows how a tiger chuffs.
Right.
And a lion roar, we do allow that in our family. That's technically true. Okay. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, so he doesn't stand a chance. They don't stand a chance.
No.
I know. It's like our 2 boys. I'm like, you guys don't stand a chance with education. I'm going to feel bad for them. That was great. That was awesome. All right. So, you know, looking specifically now, just get more into the leopard. You know, that was kind of a big, broad overview of cats. Panthera, getting into that lineages. the line splits about 6.5 million years ago, and that's where the clouded leopard kind of takes off on its own. And so they are their separate genus. They're the same family, but separate genus of clouded leopards. So they're not really a leopard per se. We call them leopards, but they're actually their own cat. So technically, we can do a whole new episode just on clouded leopards.
That's a brilliant idea, yeah. Chris.
I mean, we'll be doing this forever, like for the next 50 years, because we have so many animals to cover, which is great. The snow leopard branched off about 3.8 million years ago with the tiger. So I didn't know this. Yeah. The tiger and snow leopard are actually very closely related.
So you mean that... Okay, so the...
The clouded leopard's cloud leopard, totally by themselves.
But the snow leopard is more closely related to the tiger than it is to, say, the...
Regular leopard. Wow. Yep. Yeah.
The African leopard.
Yep, completely. And about 3 million years ago is when the snow leopard branched off from tigers. And then if you go to modern day or leopards from Asia and Africa, what we think of just the general leopards... They split with lions about 2.8 million years ago.
Okay.
The focus of today's show is the general leopard, but I've got some data on snow leopards and clouded leopards because I think they're all cool, and then we can just kind of, if we want to do a separate episode in the future on specifically say snow leopards or clouded leopards, we can.
Right, and I was kind of fascinated to learn that of the leopards in Asia and Africa, there's like eight or nine or ten basically subspecies.
Right. There is, and we'll kind of go through them a little bit. The cool thing, like I said, I think the leopards are probably one of the most widely adapted cats or predators. They live in all sorts of environments, mountains, jungles, near beaches like me. They live outside big cities, urban areas.
Cold, hot.
Right, and they've adapted well. And when we get into dietary stuff, we talk about how well they are. Now I say that the domestic cat is probably the top predator in the world.
Yes, they have us all wrapped around their little paw.
And then
they bite us.
Yeah, and I know. I'm like, I'm petting them, and I'm like, and he turns and sinks his teeth into me. I'm like, what are you doing, you little turd? I'm like, why? I love you, and I scratch you, and you gotta love them. Anyways, but yeah, cats are very well adapted, and the leopards are definitely one of the best. Now, of the 9 subspecies of leopard, there are a bunch. The one that most people are aware of, or most, I guess, can associate with, is the African leopard.
Sure, that's what I went on. I mean, I imagine I could go on a safari or a trek in parts of India and Asia and look for
leopards,
Asian leopards, mm-hmm. but I just, what comes to my mind is the classic right. Big Five in Africa.
Right, and I think, some of it is just in the media, or not media, but TV. Of course. What we watch are videos mm-hmm. of African wildlife and leopard-lion conflicts and things like that, or hyenas and leopards. So that's where we see them. They are everywhere. Like right. They're all the way over into North China.
Cold habitats.
Yeah, Korea. I mean, up in that part of the world, all the way across down to the southern tip of Africa. So they definitely are there. So the African leopard in North Africa, pretty much extinct. We'll talk a little bit about conservation status. There's a few fragmented populations, but they're done. Like the animals up there now. In sub-Saharan Africa, they're doing okay. They're vulnerable. Not great, but again, a tough species to study. The Indian leopard, again, India, Nepal. Javan leopard, which is one, and I was thinking about before we started recording earlier today. And all these hot spots, right? It seems like, because this one's the Javan leopard, mm-hmm. and there's less than, I think, 250.
Right, and flashback to a few podcasts ago when we talked about the Javan rhino.
Right.
All also these hotspots, critically right. endangered, tiny, tiny population, mm-hmm. but a hot spot, like you said.
Yeah, and I just was like, why do we have, it's the same story everywhere. And in Java and Indonesia, I think palm oil is one of the things that's been making the last couple of years people are becoming more aware of.
Yeah, too many people and habitat fragmentation. Right. And, of course, illegal poaching or hunt, maybe not even illegal, but hunting comes into play too. But yeah, all those manifest mm-hmm. into a huge population decline and potentially not even able to rebound.
It made me think, I don't want to be pointing my finger at all these countries, right?
No, definitely.
Because when
not.
I look back at the United States, we have been horrific.
Sure, we almost wiped out the eagle.
Right, the eagle, the buffalo. Mm-hmm. Used to be millions, 60, 70 million buffalo roaming the United States. Now there's
the American alligator.
20,000, right?
Another one.
Right. In California, where I grew up, the California state flag has a grizzly bear. You cannot find a grizzly bear. There hasn't been a grizzly bear in California in over 100 years.
Right.
So, you know, again, one of these things, don't, you know, we got to look at ourselves too, what we've already done.
Sure. And I think in future podcasts, we'll definitely be focusing too on North American species. Mm-hmm. Just to kind of compare and contrast, because a lot of these examples, there's been many mistakes made here in mm-hmm. North America, but through policy and through people doing mm-hmm. the groundwork and really looking out for these guys, a lot of them have rebounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Endangered Species Act has been critical mm-hmm. in saving a lot of animals. I just don't want to tell them the same story, and that's a good idea that we maybe pick a species in North America pointing my finger at the same countries in the world that, hey, right. you're all the problem. It's everywhere.
It is.
It's global. All right, so some of the other ones, there's the Arabian leopard, so the sporadic throughout the Middle East and Southwest Asia. The Anatolian leopard, again, Southwest Asia, Turkey, kind of the Caucasus region, southern Russia. The North Chinese leopard. Indo-Chinese leopard, which is more Vietnam, Thailand. The Sri Lankan leopard is one that they think might be extinct. They don't know. I've seen estimates up to 250 animals. Again, a smaller, isolated, which again, like this, the elephants and Sri Lanka, this isolated island or landmass that these animals went to, you know, millions of years ago or probably thousands of years ago and then got isolated on there. And so they're getting wiped out. And then the last one that some people might be aware of, it's if you're fortunate to see them in zoos, but that's the Amur leopard. Mm-hmm. And this is the one that's the most endangered of any leopard species. So far eastern Russia, northern China, used to be in Korea, no longer. There's only 60 in the wild.
Oh, right. That's so sad.
Now, with 60 in the wild, that means pretty much they're heading towards extinction in the wild. I know and Mongolia and maybe parts of Russia are really trying hard with conservation of certain species. So, you know, they may be working with some of the local people to keep them, but it looks like they're on their way out.
Right. I mean, potentially the numbers are there, but I mean, if a disease came through, it could easily wipe them out.
Yeah, 60 and then you talk about genetic diversity and things. Yeah. So the good thing for this species is the Amur leopard, the subspecies of leopard, is there's 200 in captivity. And I think this is a good point to bring this up, especially in you know, we're going on to episodes 5, 6, 7 as we keep building this podcast. And let's talk a little bit about what zoos do with conservation, because they do more than do.
I
know. You're doing a lot of doo-doo.
Hey, if we're talking about zookeeping or zoos, I have to make my poop jokes.
Yeah, your poop jokes. You are analyzing doo-doo, aren't you? No, so you're doing blood, too, though.
More blood this time.
Yeah, more blood, not the poop.
But I do love doo-doo.
Yeah, you do.
For the record, I will go on record anytime, anywhere saying that.
You do look at their poop quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It tells you a lot about the animal.
It does.
Yeah. You know, talking about conservation, and I, again, one of the discussions that we should be having, and, you know, hopefully when we bring in some people for interviews, we can have more deeper discussions on that. Not to remiss a little bit about the leopards today. But what I did want to address is as these animals go extinct in the wild, thankfully we do have this reserve in captivity that we're maintaining, that we're breeding and keeping healthy and happy and alive. You know, and I know there's debates whether they're happy or not. And that's, I think, the discussion we need to have with the public. But that is a huge role that zoos do, accredited zoos and accredited breeding programs.
Absolutely. And they take pride in what they do and they do it well. I've been lucky enough to spend over 7 years in an accredited zoological institute working with a lot of critically endangered mm-hmm. animals and breeding programs where animals are paired together to keep the genetic diversity and bred not for entertainment purposes and not for just for the heck of it, mm-hmm. they're bred specifically to keep these numbers, to keep this genetic bank, this genetic reserve, and with hopes of releasing them in the wild. For instance, in the Amur leopard, they could take that 60 population, add another 10 to it with a lot more genetic diversity and really help that wild mm-hmm. population explode. Mm-hmm. At least rebound.
Right.
There are many examples, which we'll touch more on throughout these podcasts, of times where accredited zoos and breeding programs, specifically what we in the industry consider the SSPs, mm-hmm. so Species Survival Programs.
Programs, right.
And the accredited zoos in North America and then also in Europe will work together.
Yeah, in Asia.
In Asia and the internationally.
The next species that you and I have already planned talking about is actually probably one of the best SSP survival stories, that this population was done, extinct, going extinct, and then we brought them back from extinction, and now they've been reintroduced into the wild. So there's many species. Last on the frogs, we were talking about the Puerto Rican frog, right?
Yeah, for most major classes of mammals, reptiles, and amphibians, mm-hmm. there are really great examples. Now, of course, it's not across the board with mm-hmm. every leopard or every frog, mm-hmm. because it takes a lot of resources and a lot of time and a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Zoos, once again, they don't overbreed the animals, so they only breed as many as they can house. Mm-hmm. And so it is a slow process, but it is there as a genetic bank that will, maybe we won't have to use it someday, but if we do have to use it, these animals can then be potentially released in the wild. And with carnivores in general, reintroduction into the wild can be a little trickier,
mm-hmm.
Because of how they hunt.
Their behaviors.
And their behaviors that they typically learn from mom at a very young age. And in a captive setting where they might not have to hunt for their food, right? Because mm-hmm. They live a nice, pretty cushy lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Then the little ones might not learn that. But interestingly enough, the conservation center that we work with here in Florida with the cheetahs, and then also the Florida panther, mm-hmm. they rehabilitate those guys. And we'll release them into the wild. And they have been working on protocols for carnivores to actually, if they haven't had access to learning from mom how to hunt mm-hmm. prey, they have really cool kind of runs where they literally train them right. on how to hunt. And so this is just to give you all very the listeners brief. Out there a right. very brief description right. on the efforts and the passion and the hard work that a lot of these not only zoo professionals but conservationists and work both at the local level right. and then also at the international level to save these species.
Right, and that's the direction you're going in your career, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is, you know, the conservation science and trying to do this
to do right as best as we can by the animals, right. the whole being, the welfare, the physiology, mm-hmm. the conservation. It's a all these issues are very, very complex. Mm-hmm. But if we don't work together, and if one side says, no, this is the right way, and the other right. side says, no, this is the right way, right. as we can take a look in our government, then you don't get anywhere.
You don't get it, and the animals will suffer.
And the animals will be gone.
And we're the animals, right? The people are suffering.
Right, yeah. I mean, these animals will go extinct, uh-huh. so... There's not, you know, that's the thing is, I definitely believe that accredited zoos are open to learning on how to do things better. And that's right. why they hire zoo scientists.
Right. And I think, you know, the last few years as I've jumped into getting away from domestics and getting into exotics and doing some of this endangered species research. And I had a friend a few months ago talk to me about zoos. And he found out that I was doing elephant research. And he was telling me about how he went to the zoo. And he just felt so bad for the elephants in captivity. And I didn't get mad. I'm definitely not defensive. Like, it's a discussion I wanted to have with him.
And it's a very realistic opinion
right.
that many people have. And that I had even years and years right. and years ago when I was probably like a teenager or mm-hmm. something. But it wasn't until I was actually working in a zoological institute along all the conservationists, mm-hmm. the nutritionists, the scientists, mm-hmm. the staff, the keeper staff, mm-hmm. the volunteers. And then, of course, knowing how we partnered with other zoos,
right.
both nationally and internationally, right. and scientists, and to see the cooperative efforts. And yeah, do we always make the right steps? No, but they're trying to learn and get right. better. And it all helps the conservation, the animals
right, that's the
at
bottom
the zoo,
line,
but
right.
then also...
I think that's the most, I mean, it's not so much, hey, you know, connecting people to animals, which is important.
Sure.
I think. And education is very important.
Very important.
I think. The conservation is critical.
Sure.
It is. It's not what I think it is. It is very important. And without zoos, there would be fewer species.
Sure, and zoos are some of the largest contributors to a lot of these conservation programs. The one we mentioned at each end of the podcast, I can guarantee you most zoological institutions donate money and support.
Yeah, I think it
was
like $160 million last year is what they've donated to research. And
I don't know the number off the top of my
head. I think it was roughly that the AZA did.
Yeah, we can put
that's just in America.
Right? We can put there's some nice graphics. We can put them
on the show notes.
Yep, on the show notes. And because, yeah, it's quite impressive. Right.
Okay, well, I don't want to, you know, again, this is a discussion that I think we need to have with people, and people need to give us feedback. Like, hey, tell us.
Please.
Yeah. I mean, go to an accredited zoo. You know, I grew up going to San Diego Zoo. Go to there and say, hey, I saw this. What does that mean? And why is it this way? And the AZA is very strict, you know, working with people within the industry, working with other scientists. And I know a couple of zoos have gotten shut down, gotten in big trouble for having the animal, really animal welfare is the big concern right now, and as it should be. So anyways, let's get back to leopards. It's, again, I wanted to bring that up because I think zoos are going to save the Amur leopard.
Yes.
I think, you know, throughout the world.
They are the only hope.
They're the only hope for that, for them, I think. Other than that, they're done. Unlike the northern white rhino, which I think is done. There's nothing we can do. There's only three. Now, the snow leopard, I just talked a little bit about snow leopards and clouded leopards. Since they are separate, but I love snow leopards, Andy. I love them.
I mean, I told you, I think that they're the one of the cutest little cubs there are.
They are. I think they're the most beautiful cat in the world.
They're stunning.
Right. And I guess going back to the zoo thing, and I don't work for a zoo. I haven't been ever paid by a zoo. I mean, I taught at the local zoo for a while because I'm so passionate about this stuff. It's just... I was fortunate when I was dating my wife and she was working as a zookeeper and I got to work with the snow leopards and get to scratch them through because we teach them to come up to the cage wire, present their shoulders for shots and things like that. And you could scratch them. And I just was like, oh my God, they're amazing. They're so beautiful. They love them, love them, love them. They live in Mongolia, China, Nepal, Pakistan, Afghanistan. So we'll touch a little bit about that. And then the other one was the clouded leopard. Again, why I love the clouded leopards is a quick story about me and Ashley, my wife. I actually proposed to her in the clouded leopard service area.
Oh, stop. I didn't know that.
So I had her friend sneak me into the zoo. Her favorite animals were the clouded leopards. Her favorite animal's name was Max.
Aww.
He was a big, sweet little boy with big canines. So if you don't know, the clouded leopard has the largest canine teeth to skull ratio of any animal on Earth.
I did not know
that. Yeah, so like they're like the true last saber-toothed cat, even though they're not sabers, but they're huge canine teeth. Anyways, I got let in the service area, and then they called over the radio that she needed to come to Max's service area. And she came in, and I'm there, and I'm like, hey, and it's kind of, you know, it was great, though.
Oh, that's
I got
so
on the knee
cute.
In the service area and proposed to her, and then that night we went and had a big barbecue with her family and stuff. But, yeah, Max was, like, her love, and it was funny when we were dealing with Katrina and all those hurricanes in that part of the United States, and she was like, if I have to evacuate, I'm just going to throw Max in the back of my car, because, like, he was the sweetest cat. Probably would have scratched the hell out of her.
Oh, yes, yes. This is all, remind you, all this to Ryan, our listeners.
Yeah, these are not
this
pets.
Is all, yeah, this is all through protected contact
right.
that they're doing.
We're behind fences and strong things. I mean, even scratching a snow leopard was because he presented his shoulder and I could
sure.
scratch him really quick. But
yeah, which are, those are behaviors that they're trained to do to benefit their,
right.
usually
yeah.
their
And probably would have got her fired
medical.
If they knew I was doing that. But anyways, here we are years later. And,
well, no, but if it, that's the thing. If it lights a fire and gets you passionate, that's... I mean, I have very similar stories about rhinos and zebras and all that. And yes, the understanding their personality, and that's a thing we've talked about even with the frogs. The frogs I worked with had personality.
Right.
And crazy. Obviously Max. I mean, he sounds
like he was great.
A charmer. I mean, honestly, it was probably our first love.
Yeah.
And you were her second.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
That's okay. It's fine. She loves Max. You know, they were beautiful though. Their coats look like clouds. That's why they're called the clouded leopard. Now, let's go back to just the general leopard, the African and the Asian subspecies. So, widest range of any cat.
Yeah, they're
like
all over.
Said, yeah, they've Africa to Asia. They all over the place. Strictly solitary. So, these do not live in pairs or groups, except when you're young.
Sure,
you're obviously mom.
Stay with mama.
Mom with the babies.
Mom teaches them how to hunt.
They about 26% of the range. They have very large ranges. So anywhere from on average is about 180 square kilometers or 70 square miles.
That's what I was reading. It's huge. Yeah, that's a lot.
That's huge. That's huge.
Which, unfortunately, there's a lot of people around or habitat fragmentation. That's
it gets harder. Like we talked about, you know, putting the fences up and say, here's your range. Right. And that's not their natural range.
No,
and
then they're forced to do something different, or potentially go into public areas or whatnot.
Or fight to the death with them or other carnivores. Some ranges are up to 1,000 kilometers, or what is that, like 400 square miles?
Wow.
Yeah, some, depending on, you know, the region, but that's huge. So, again, prey abundance is going to affect that rainfall habitat, like we're talking about in Africa, when you're putting up these fence lines and saying, this is it, this is where you live now.
Right.
That's where I think we're seeing a lot of problems with them.
And it's also a trickle-down effect, or trickle-up, however we look at it, where since they are large predators and they prey on smaller antelopes and rodents and whatnot, as those populations are in decline,
right,
certain ones, then that's going to have a, you know, trickle-up effect on these leopards.
And that's what, especially when we're getting to conservation, talking about the reduction in prey has a direct correlation with the reduction in predator. You know, it's nature imbalance. There's not enough to eat, so they starve to death or don't breed and die out.
Right.
Right. So that's what we're seeing. That's why I think we're seeing a large reduction in leopard populations with that. What are some of the things with history and humans? What did you find?
Well, kind of what we had touched on earlier is they are iconic because they're beautiful and their coats. They're also elusive. But, I mean, since the beginning of documented time, like you said, with the cave art and whatnot, we've seen a relationship of leopards and humans. And whether it's in art or mythology, folklore, just storytelling, everywhere across Asia and Africa, from ancient Greece to Persia to Rome. And a lot of cultures, they symbolize power and being a king, because they're considered the king of the forest or the jungle or wherever they live. And then interestingly enough, there's historic documentation in Egypt and in England of having leopards as pets.
Yeah.
And domestication, which I frown upon. But I'm sure, you know, that they were maybe able to do it, and it was probably a symbol of power, and especially during some of these cultures that had the kings and the rulers.
Just to jump in real quick, I know seeing that happen in the Middle East today, as, you know, obviously there's a lot of wealth there, it's not leopards, but cheetahs. And that's a big problem, is going out and killing the mom, getting the cubs. This is probably what they did. And then hand raise the cubs. Because we know the conservation center we work with, they have a couple handable cheetahs that have been hand raised. So people are keeping cheetahs as pets, which is horrible.
Horrible.
Because cheetahs are like on their way out. They're heading towards extinction.
Yeah.
Now you're just going out for... Oh, it makes me so angry. It makes me so angry because a cheetah should not be a pet.
Yes, nor should a leopard. Right. You're right. You don't really see leopards as much as, and we'll, in a different podcast on a different day, we'll talk a little bit more about the pet trade and how there are more tigers in Texas, in the state of Texas, as pets, not in zoos, as pets. So who knows what kind of care they're under than there are in Asia.
Right.
So more tigers in Texas. Granted, it's a big state.
Still.
Than in Asia.
And not, you know, and talk about their genetics being messed up.
Ugh, yeah, horrible.
A lot of inbreeding and stuff.
And, you know, and it's typical to a lot of the pet trade where, and of course this is the exotic pet trade, but it even happens with domestics where you get this cute little cuddly little thing and it's furry and it's adorable, and then it gets big and annoying, and we have dogs that get big and annoying and people dump them and get rid of them. A big cat.
A 400-pound cat.
Or like a chimpanzee or whatever goofy pet people think they want, exotic animal they think they want. Then they end up in sanctuaries. Yeah. And
they're overflowing.
And the sanctuaries are overflowing. They don't have enough resources, enough time. So
back to money.
Yeah, I don't think we see that as much with the leopard, probably because just in general they are that much more elusive to capture and whatnot. But historically, yeah, there has been documentation of them as pets. And then if you fast forward to more of the modern day, we see leopard obviously as a symbol, once again, of beauty and power and grace and agility. Sometimes it's team mascots. Mm-hmm. And then in Africa, especially with the ecotourism, the leopard is one of the big five.
Right.
And also in Asia. It's a really highly sought after animal for tours. Can be very hard to see because it is mostly nocturnal, but people, I mean, because they're so beautiful, people really want to see them. And that's, ecotourism has helped out a lot of local communities, and ecotourism, when it's done right, has probably helped increase some of their wild population numbers. And so that's more of your feel-good story, and that's what we need.
Right. We need a lot more of that. Ecotourism. And I think as people get more globally conscious and want to travel more, it's easier to travel, it's more affordable. And as more countries generate wealth, I guess, and you can afford to travel to Africa for ecotourism and stuff, I think people, you know, it definitely, I know for a fact, supports animal conservation. And that's where we're transitioning, right?
Absolutely. Right. I mean, there's been a lot of scientific studies pinpointing that really the most sustainable way to help a lot of these critically endangered species is through ecotourism and then also through educating the locals in the community to give them a little bit more of kind of encouragement. Right. Yeah, of course, financially, but then also excitement and wanting to help protect these guys.
Yeah, protect their environment,
right? Whether if it's from poachers or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So if the communities surrounding these wildlife preserves can benefit, then it's a win-win.
Yeah, it's a win-win for both. It's definitely a one. So kind of some of the things about the life cycle of the leopard, and this is kind of typical for some big cats, but male leopards are called leopards, and then the females are called leopardess.
Oh, leopardess.
You get a little S at the end. Mm-hmm. In the wild, they live only about 12. And this is interesting to me, too, because dealing with, again, like Max and some of the other carnivores in captivity, I know in captivity they can live, you know, 16, 17. The snow leopards I got to mess with, they're long gone, but, you know, this is a decade ago. They were 16, 17 years old.
I think documented somewhere is a leopard that lived to be 25,
right,
in a captive setting.
So if they get their food, they're not stressed. They
oh sure,
free medical, free dental, all that stuff.
Yeah,
that
no, it's a pretty good gig, and a lot of the carnivores that were at the zoo that I worked at were what we call considered geriatric, and it was really amazing. And our zoo even did a lot of research and education about the geriatric care of these cats,
right,
and how what the keepers and the staff do to help them be comfortable, and then also what the veterinarians do to make sure that they're, like you said, their medical, their teeth, their just overall their care is that much more accelerated and enhanced as they grow old. And zoos are committed, unlike a lot of the exotic pet owners, zoos are that much more are committed to taking care of them as they live well beyond their reproductive lifespan. Yeah, and
you say they have their own nutritionist, they have their own doctor.
Their
own keeper 24/7.
Their own endocrinologist.
So, right.
That's the job I want.
Yeah, I know, doing endocrinology. So yeah, it's interesting that in captivity, they doesn't mean there's not issues with captivity. And again, that's why I think we need to have this discussion, especially with the public, what are concerns and why people feel the way they do, because that's where we need to address that. But that these animals do live very hard lives in the wild.
Oh, sure.
They're, you know, full of worms and insects and mites and ticks. And they live a hard life.
Well, and you're not going to probably see it with a leopard because, once again, they're nocturnal. And so pictures of them during the day, they're coming down with, they're either hunting because they have to, or they're at a watering hole. But animals that are out in the African sun and really, really hard lives are lions.
Right.
So any picture that has not been photoshopped or enhanced is going to show that lion or lioness with about 1,000 flies and Lord knows what, bitten up bloody ears, flies in their eyes. It's tough. And that's just life. How they know how to, you know, they try to seek out shade and they groom themselves and whatnot. But there's a lot of hardships in the wild. Right. And so.
And that's why they don't live as long.
And that's why they don't live as long. One of the many reasons. Yeah.
So their life cycle, you know, and you'll probably get into this with Repro, you know, 2 to 4 years after they're born is when they're ready to breed. Right. Mm-hmm. And they're with mom. But for about almost 2 years?
About 2 years.
Yeah, 1 to 2 years with mom. And then again, they live to about 12 in the wild. As far as the different subspecies of leopard, no big differences. Some differences in size and maybe a little skull shape's a little bit different. you know, especially the Arabian leopard versus, say, the Javan leopard or something like that. But again, generally, all pretty much look similar. They all stand about 28 inches or, you know, 2.5 feet at the shoulder, or 70 centimeters, going back to my metric.
Good job.
They can be as long as 75 inches or 100 centimeters, or almost as long as I am tall.
Okay.
You know, six foot three is what 75 is.
Including their tail?
Yeah, that's from head to tail. Pretty long. They weigh about 200 pounds, or the largest males weigh about that.
You know, females are going
to
be less.
Yeah, about 150 to 200 pounds. So pretty big size. Again, mm-hmm. A little less than me. Bigger than you. Much bigger than you.
Thank you, Chris.
Yes.
Three, two of
Angie equals one leopard. You heard it here first, folks.
Put that on record.
And the snow leopards are smaller, a little bit smaller than general leopards. And then the clouded leopards are the smallest of the three. And they're about a medium-sized dog, or about 50 pounds.
And so, now, are all their leopard spots different?
So the snow leopards and the leopards have what's called rosettes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the clouded leopards have like that clouded pattern.
Mm-hmm.
The rosettes, when you look at the carnivore cats or the large cat patterns, you see in jags and leopards. The jags have little spots in between.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's the difference between them and a leopard. And basically what the rosettes are, or what they think genetically, or what they've shown, is so cheetahs have flecks.
Spots.
Spots, right? So they have these dark, they call them flecks, spots throughout their body. The leopard and jags, they actually have flecks that just got lighter in the middle.
Oh, and kept interesting. That powder
shape. So yeah. Okay. So that's the difference. Obviously, tigers have stripes, mm-hmm. and then the lions just have a plain yellow coat.
And what's the benefit of this gorgeous coat pattern?
Oh, easily camouflage.
Yeah.
So to hunt, and you know, we'll definitely.
So that's why I can't see them on safari.
Oh yeah, I mean they're tough. Yeah. I mean, you know, you think about the desert, or the desert, the middle of a forest, and the light patterns
and they're in
stuff.
A tree,
right? And you can't see them.
Yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't even know if they were behind you, and then they jump on you. Ah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, but some cat behaviors.
Okay, my favorite section mm-hmm. of all behavior. Well, we talked a little bit about their nutrition, how they're opportunistic hunters, but they also, you might be fascinated to learn, I know I was, that they're really great swimmers.
Mm.
And that's what they'll right. go. They'll even go for fish or crabs if they have to, right. which we all think, ooh, cats hate water.
Cats hate water, yeah.
I know mine does. Right. So, and whether they like it or don't like it, they use it as a tool
mm-hmm.
because, once again, they're so opportunistic and so able to adapt to whatever setting they're in. And they're not as fast as a cheetah, but they can run up to about 36 miles per hour.
Yeah, it's pretty fast.
Or for you, Chris. What's okay?
Oh,
quick
geez.
Quiz. No calculator. 36 miles per hour.
I wrote this down. Let me see.
Just double
8
it.
8 million kilometers.
Just, no, just double it and right? then subtract it.
Yeah, I was
going to
say
bit.
It's like 70 kilometers per hour. Is that
58.
Oh, I'm way off.
I mean, it's
what's
okay.
a kilometer to a mile? I'll learn this.
Yeah.
I'll learn this.
That's okay. There's time for that.
Ask me in a year. In there a year, go. I will have it nailed.
There you go.
Yeah, right.
There you go. But yeah, they're solitary unless it's mom and cubs. However, interestingly enough, the males, there's more studies of them now mm-hmm. than there ever has been because of the awesome technology mm-hmm. of radio collaring and then also photo ID traps.
Mm-hmm.
Because of them being nocturnal, a lot of these populations that Chris and I are talking about today that obviously are critically endangered or vulnerable, they're pretty good guesses, mm-hmm. but they're not even as accurate as a lot of other species are because they're so elusive and they're so hard to count because them being nocturnal and also they don't want to be near humans either.
Mm-hmm.
Through the help of using radio collars and these photo traps, they've learned a lot more about them. And once again, these animals keep blowing our minds mm-hmm. or our human
learning
hypothesis
new stuff, yep.
Hypotheses of what we think, where the male has been documented helping the female a little bit and the cubs. Hmm. Not all species, but there has been some of that behavior
cool,
recorded.
Usually you think, I mean, I know with lions, and this is one of the worst things. I know when I think I saw one of the first documentaries ever to document this, but when a male takes over a pride, he kills all the cubs.
Sure.
Which is just horrifying.
Sad, yeah.
But it is his purpose is my genes,
it's work.
My genetics, and it will yeah. bring the girls into estrus
mm-hmm.
or for breeding. They'll want to mm-hmm. breed quicker than lactation and raising the cubs. So they've actually seen this patricide happen. And I just like, oh, it breaks my heart thinking about it. Yeah, so leopards, maybe not so much. And I'm sure mom defends them. I mean, even in bears, like that happens in bears or grizzly bears, right? They don't mess with a mama bear.
No, never mess with mama bear.
Yeah, because she will come after you.
I can be a mama bear
sometimes. Yeah, I mean, I'll be a mama bear.
More so than I ever thought. I was like, I would never be like that. Oh, but God. Now my two boys, watch out. But I can promise the podcast listeners out there, I will not be a helicopter mom.
Yeah, there you go.
Those are the worst. But yeah, so males may, some studies show that they may have a little bit of a role.
Yeah.
But it's basically the maternal bond with the cub is very strong. And
so they're not deadbeat dads, like you said last week.
They're not deadbeat dads. They're
kind of
deadbeat dads. they're like a step
drop
up.
Drop some meat off.
And, yeah, maybe a step up from a deadbeat dad and like a step down from a stepdad or something. Somewhere in between. But of course the mother's role is super critical. And cubs will, about 6 weeks, they start climbing trees because leopards spend a lot of time in trees, as we've already touched on. And they're also notorious for their strength, which Chris touched on. But they'll drag whole carcasses up into the tree.
Cachane.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so the little cubs will learn that from them. And then by 3 months of age, the cubs will start to learn to assist with hunts. So mom will actually take them out with them and teach them what she does.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, because, you know, we've seen quite a few documentaries on cheetahs. Disney did that movie, right? Mm-hmm. The Big Cats, which was a cool one. Like African cats. Like I
highly recommended.
That scene with, was it five male lions at the end? I'm like, I've never been blown away. I mean, I've always been blown away by nature documentaries, but that one where I saw five male lions together. And that shows some, I guess, we should do lions because that's kind of the pressures that they're under, that they're forming these bachelor groups that take over. But anyways, there is a bunch with cheetah cubs in there and, you know.
And the cubs, just like your kittens at home or whatever, but they wrestle all the time and they do all these super adorable things. But once again, that's all them establishing dominance and learning to play fight and whatnot.
Hunt, yeah.
And there has, research has shown that with females, once again, they're solitary, except for when they're breeding, and we'll touch on that. But their territories can overlap a little bit. Mm. Now, is that because territories are getting smaller, or was it historically always like that? Mm. We don't know. In one park, I think it was in Africa, southern Africa, they showed where there's a pretty dense amount of leopards, radio collared, that they would come within a kilometer of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do see each other, they may vocalize with growls or snarls, meows, they even purr.
Mm-hmm.
And they can roar, but they're also very well known for what's called a sawing vocalization.
Yeah, I've heard that one before.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting way, but they say that this noise sounds like a saw. So if you'll bear with me in my technological difficulties. So here's a common leopard vocalization to give you a little bit of an idea of what this sawing is.
Cool.
So that's a sawing roar. And so it's different than what we think of, you know, the king of the jungle, the big roar. But it really unique sounds. And once again, the way they vocalize or they snarl or whatnot or growl is going to help communicate with one another. I like you or I don't like you. But typically, they're not aggressive with each other. And like you touched on a little bit earlier, they probably have more conflicts with either other big cats like lions or hyenas than they do with each other.
Right.
They probably have a common language of like, okay, let's just leave each other.
And that kind of gets into when I talk about the hunting behavior. If they get hurt, they die. If they get hurt back because they can't hunt, they die.
Yeah. And so if two males, even in a breeding situation, if they're fighting over a female or whatnot or a territory, usually one of them is going to retreat before, like you said, they get this horrible injury that they'll die from.
Yeah, it will kill them.
And so other than that, the cubs make a little bit of a different sound, which it's like a yurr, yurr. So I don't know if that's, maybe that's an outtake, but I got to work on that one. But it's definitely a cute little sound. Yeah. So, but then rolling into a little bit about their reproductive behavior, a male, he might be a deadbeat or not so deadbeat dad. But he goes to great lengths
to court
to travel after his female. kind of like you going into the
Max's service area.
Yeah, the service area to court jumping. Ashley. Yeah, to jump through all those hoops to court her. And so that's been documented. Mm-hmm. That they will to meet with a female, and they do fight each other. Mm-hmm. But once again, it's not super aggressive. And when they do find the love of their life, they will only pair for a couple days, typically. Mm-hmm. Unless maybe once the cubs are born, we might see that male come back into it. And as throughout these days when they're courting each other, they'll sometimes even hunt in teams.
Oh, wow.
And they share their
meal,
their catch as a reward, which I think is really interesting.
Huh.
And of course, over these days, they mate multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets into a little bit of, I mean, mating multiple times, people are like, oh, they just like to have fun.
No.
Perhaps
yeah.
they
yeah.
do.
Yeah.
But typically with the felines, the female needs to be bred or mate a few times because she's what's known as an induced ovulator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's just a fancy lingo for she doesn't release an egg. Like women, we release our egg once
a month
regardless of, you know, as long
mating
as we're over, after puberty.
Yeah.
Typically, a lot of cat species, not all of them, but a lot of them are going to only release an egg after the physical stimulation of mating.
Right.
But so with that being said, female leopards don't have seasonality.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit, they think, maybe in snow leopards, probably because of the cold weather. But in general, the male will find a female that's in estrus. So they have estrus where they're giving off signs to the male in their urine of like, hey, I am ready.
Yeah, that's behavioral.
Behavioral, they rub. Right. I'm sure if anybody's ever seen a female cat that wasn't spayed when she should have been spayed, please spay and neuter your pets.
Yes, please, yes.
Like, sorry to be the Price is Right.
No,
here.
I know. It's somebody. Bob Barker. But
I'm dating myself, right? Yeah, yeah.
I know.
I know you're dating yourself with Bob Barker
Oh,
there.
God, yeah.
But anyways, if we had one of those that we adopted and we were told she was spayed and she wasn't spayed one day I'm like, is she dying? Because she sounds like she's dying right now.
Indeed.
And then, you know, I'm like, duh, Angie, the screaming and the rolling
so
and the presenting and the backing her little tushy up into anything that'll come. So the leopard, although it's, you know, it's a lot bigger than our domestic cat, the female will show a lot of those to tell
same
the male.
Signs, yeah.
But once again, she can do all of that, and if there's not a male around, she's not going to ovulate. But then, when she is pregnant, the pregnancy, depending on the leopard species, of course, but it varies from about 90 days to 105 days.
Mm-hmm.
So, quick math, that's like, what, three to four
right.
months?
Yeah.
So, not that long of gestation period compared.
Pretty quick,
mm-hmm. And, of course, they're a litter, just like mm-hmm. our normal domestic cats. And there's usually about 2 to 4 at a time, depending on the species. They're small at birth, but they grow quickly. But another interesting fact about leopards is they have a cub mortality rate of about 50%.
Wow, yeah. So it's really tough for them to survive.
Very tough for them to survive. And so that's a thing in general, if we're talking about low numbers for some of these critically endangered, like the Javan leopard, is like, oh, yes, they can probably, you know, have a litter at least once or twice a year. But how many of those cubs will survive? And then it still takes them another 2 years to reach sexual maturity.
Right.
And so there's still a lot of
the generational interval is still
can be long, and the infant mortality rate is pretty high compared to other species,
yeah,
litter bearing species. So, but some of the good news, and I know we spoke a little bit earlier about zoos and what they're doing for wildlife as far as acting as a genetic reservoir with the SSPs, but they're also not just trying to breed them naturally. Because some of these animals in captivity and in the wild have these either fertility issues or infant, I don't know.
Mortality.
Infant, cub mortality issues. So they've been using a lot of artificial reproductive technologies such as artificial insemination, embryo transfer, and they're really trying to apply it. The zoo scientists both in North America and in Europe internationally are trying to apply it to some of these really critically endangered cat species.
Right.
They've been working on it in the, I'm not sure about the Amur. How does it
Amur leopard. Yeah.
I'm not sure about it in the Amur leopard, but they had their first ever successful birth via artificial insemination in a clouded leopard in Nashville just recently, like this past year. And unfortunately, they've been trying with a snow leopard, and it hasn't worked out.
Yeah.
But they're going to keep trying, and that's the thing that I think we need to educate people about, or people should, I don't want to say should applaud zoos for doing this, It goes to show
the depth.
The depth that zoos are
doing. If you're not
doing.
In the industry or you don't work with people in the industry, sometimes it's hard to see what behind the scenes.
Sure.
And I know zoos are trying to be more apparent on what they're doing. From our perspective, because reproductive biologists and what we've done.
Yeah, and a lot of the accredited zoos are now even starting to do public surveys and get like data on what would make visitors happy.
Right.
So if you are ever at your local zoo and there is a survey you can fill out,
yeah, give them feedback,
or a volunteer you can talk to, or a keeper you can talk to. I mean, they definitely want feedback.
Right, because we got to answer these concerns. But the point I was going to make was, like, especially with this AI stuff, because one of the things I know zoos are working at is just trying to reduce stress any way they can.
Absolutely.
And how we normally breed these animals is shipping them, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's how we exchange their genetics, let them breed naturally.
Right. So basically, there might be a clouded leopard in Nashville, a male, but the female that has the best genetics or the furthest
match for her.
The furthest,
for him.
Yeah, the best genetic match, so the furthest relation to him might be in
San Diego
right. Zoo, which is very far away.
And so what we do is we put them on an airplane, ship them, which is stressful, knock them down, put them in a container, ship them to San Diego, or she's shipped to Nashville, and then you try to get them to breed for a few years.
And cross your fingers.
So if we have these artificial techniques, we can not only really promote genetic diversity, it's easier to ship. And I know the work that we're doing in elephants, that's kind of one of our end game goals, is to try to figure out how to preserve the male semen or sperm or
right.
the male gametes so we can freeze them and ship them around the world, because shipping an elephant is not easy.
It's not possible.
It's so expensive.
And there's definitely a lot more diverse genetics in European zoological institutes
and, can't really,
and conservation centers.
You can't put them on an airplane. I mean, I'm sure they do ship them on
airplanes,
but it's like,
that's it. And that's where it's like, we know that's not in the animal's best interest.
No.
And would we do it to keep that species alive? Potentially.
For sure, yeah.
But do we want to do it? Is that the most efficient way?
No, definitely not.
So,
there is research going on. A lot behind the scenes that people need to know about.
Yeah, and I think that if you even get on the internet and look around at San Diego Global Zoo, they're doing a lot of really important reproductive research and cryopreservation of semen and genetic banking and trying to figure out how to help a lot of these species from frogs to birds to large mammals.
And I'll say it here too, that we're going to eventually, especially because we're launching official launch in a couple weeks, we will have interviews with some of these professionals.
Absolutely.
And we will be doing outtakes. And then on the Patreon, we'll have the full interviews up there. So we're going to start scheduling those here pretty quick. And you can talk to some of these researchers that are actually doing this work.
Absolutely.
Because you're working with, people from San Diego and the researchers that, again, are working with the northern whites and some of these critical species. So it's good to hear from their perspective.
Oh, yes, definitely, to kind of have a bird's eye view of what's going on in the whole big picture.
All right, so just jump into nutrition. I know we kind of talked about this. These are carnivores. They are meat eaters, and mainly hoofstock, smaller hoofstock, gazelles and impala and deer, I guess, if you're in Asia. They do eat some monkeys and rodents and some birds. They are stalkers, and we talked about that, like at night is really when they do, in their coats, they're very good at camouflage, so they kind of just jump out, but they can be pretty quick. I think the coolest thing about the leopard species is them caching, bringing their kills up in the trees. They're just so incredibly strong to be able to climb those trees. They've actually seen a baby giraffe, which kills me, a baby giraffe. But,
Circle of life.
Circle of life, I know. And they've actually dragged a baby giraffe in a tree.
Well, it's such a interesting evolutionary skill set, because that's going to set them apart from lions and or tigers if they're in Asia and other big cats that don't do that behavior.
Right. And they do it because they lose their kills to other predators, lions.
Absolutely.
And then the good old hyena,
the
pack of hyenas that come in. So they lose about 10% of their kills.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, to other predators. So
okay.
The one thing I thought was interesting, because I know, as you and I delve into this and learn more, the myth that the predator always found the weak one, right? The one that, and I think they still do, probably to an extent, the one that's injured or easier to catch.
Old.
But they really, the majority of kills, especially in leopard research, they're all in great body condition. They're not the sick or injured or the weak-looking ones. They're taking down strong animals, which is interesting, because again, if they get hurt and they can't hunt, they get hungry, they get weaker and weaker, and they end up dying.
Game over, yeah.
All right, it's over for them. Now, I found a really cool scientific study kind of talking about their prey preference. So mm-hmm. I think this would be really, really interesting. Obviously going to depend on where they are in the world.
Of course, and what's available.
Right, so most of this data was from Africa, but they do have them catching catfish.
Yeah,
so fish,
that's awesome.
So cats do like fish, mm-hmm. and they like catfish. Rabbits, birds, rodents, we talked about that. You talked about the giraffe calf. They've even had them taken down an adult male eland.
Yikes.
Which can weigh up to 2,000 pounds.
Remind our listeners what an eland looks like.
Okay, so it's a big hoof stalk, huge. It's got the dewlap, right? The neck and mm-hmm. the big spiral long horns.
Yes.
Big
horns.
Yeah. A leopard, that's me, okay? A little less than me, okay? Because I'm about 230 pounds. 200-pound animal running and jumping on the back of a bull.
Yeah.
And biting its neck and trying to bring down a domestic bull. No thanks.
Yeah.
You watch those rodeo guys.
That's not the one I would pick. Yeah.
So there have been instances of them taking that, but that's not the average. The average they take is the smaller hoof stock from the 50 to 200 pound.
But they
range.
Will do like rodents and.
Yeah, they will. They very big diet. The in Africa, their prey preference were again gazelle and impala was most of the kills. Rock hyrax. So there you go. There's your rodent. I know we're doing some rock hyrax research with the elephants.
Which, interestingly enough, is very closely related to the elephants.
I know. This little thing that looks like a rat with teeth.
Gotta love evolution.
Yeah. Yeah. Elephants, manatees, and rock hyrax. That's the research we're doing with Danielle. So some of the things they've noticed them catching. So aardvarks, 1%. Cape buffalo. They're probably young sub-adults.
It must be young.
Young, yeah. Chimpanzees, 1%. Colobus monkeys. Porcupines. We talked about porcupines, but 7% of the kills were porcupines.
Ouch, that doesn't even seem like a good idea.
Maybe flipping them or something.
Huh.
Gorilla, I saw 1%. Wow. So probably sub-adults, young adults. They, again, you talked about how fast they were. Their success rates on hunting, it can be as low as 5%.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, that's really bad.
Spending a lot of energy.
Yeah, less than 1 out of 10. I mean, 0.5 out of 10 or, you know, 5 out of 100 hunts in the Serengeti. And then in Kudam, they have about a 35 to 40% success rate. So it depends on, I guess, prey abundance. And you think about Serengeti, too. It's the plain, right?
Sure.
So there's not a lot of places for them to hide.
No.
And ambush. On average, each leopard takes about 40 to 60 kills a year.
Okay.
So that's about how many they can kill. And like I said, they lose about 10%
of their catch.
Yeah, of catch per year to other predators.
Scavenging.
Yeah, and I've seen a video or it was a documentary on hyenas like jumping up and actually pulling down a leopard kill that was accidentally hanging down. So they do get harried, you know, from other predators. This was really interesting from this study. When they have a choice of prey,
mm-hmm.
their number one preference is cheetahs. They kill other predators.
Wow.
And they have a high preference.
Adults?
Yes. They try to kill cheetahs.
Hmm.
Now, that was kind of like sad at one point, but then, yeah, it's competition.
Sure.
They didn't have instances of eating the cheetah, but they do kill other predators out of spite, I guess, or just competition. You know, chasing them off.
Yeah, territory.
Mm-hmm. So civets, Cape foxes, they've killed. Now, they completely avoid elephants. You know, obviously leopards not going to take down an elephant. My babies, no way. Hippos, we're going to do hippos.
Hippos, we will do hippos.
We'll do hippos. Within the next year, we will do hippos. Oh my
That's my
God.
Husband's favorite. Yeah. And I do a great hippo sound for the record. But I'm going to keep you listening, okay?
Yeah, we'll do that in a year. Our year anniversary, we'll do hippos.
Yeah.
Yeah, they kill more people than any other animal on Earth.
They do.
They are nasty. But great.
They are not nasty.
I love hippos way, way away.
Don't want to get in their territory.
No.
Because then they will kill you.
Again, seeing videos on the internet now of like a hippo chasing a boat. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Mountain zebras. They don't go after mountain zebras.
Well, a kick from a zebra is about as powerful as a hand grenade.
Yeah, so don't mess with them.
They're smart. They probably do maybe some babies.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Rhinos, don't mess with rhinos. And then, Angie, you got to wait for it. This one, I just died laughing. One of the animals they avoid completely is the honey badger.
I don't blame them. Yeah. I'm looking at a picture of it right now.
I love these guys. We are doing an episode on honey badgers soon.
They might be the littlest, toughest animal in the whole world.
They are the nastiest, meanest SOBs, but I love them. Yeah. I love them. One of my favorite documentaries was on this honey badger that kept getting out of his exhibit. Not exhibit. I think it was a pet in South Africa, but it kept building things to climb out. Like, it was so intelligent.
Yeah.
And then my wife, when she was in South Africa, working with beekeepers,
mm-hmm.
the only thing that scared them was honey badgers.
Wow.
Because they'd come and just destroy their hives.
Oh.
And just, they love honey, and they are nasty.
And they're tough.
And they're tough, and animals don't mess with them.
And clearly leopards are like...
Leopards do not even go near them. And I will definitely put a picture of a honey badger
up. Yeah, we'll have to do another episode on them. I would like to learn more about why they're so damn tough.
Yeah, they're great. So meat digestion, you know, it's kind of like us. They have shorter digestive systems, about 20 hours from once they eat these big meals. They eat about 20% of their body weight. So 20 pounds for, you know, not even that. It's 100 pounds. So it'd be 40 pounds, right? 40 pounds of meat. Mm-hmm. That's insane. So that's what predators do. They have
large meals.
Yeah, they eat these huge meals. They gorge themselves and then sleep for a couple days, then mm-hmm. go out and hunt again and get another one.
And so briefly, my organization of the week that I picked... And there's lots of good ones, but it's called African Wildlife Foundation, and you can find it at www.awf.org, and then you can search for the leopard, because they specialize in a few different mammals and reptiles and amphibians, but there's a specific section that works just with the leopard conservation, and their main solution to some of the complex issues are to work with the local people, which peer-reviewed evidence has shown definitely helps. And then... Like I mentioned earlier, they use GPS, Global Positioning System, collars to study these leopards.
Right.
So your donation goes to helping them be able...
Do their research.
To be able to put more collars on more leopards so we can understand more about their behavior. As you can see, my behavior section wasn't as robust as I would normally like.
Right.
Because in order to help save these guys, we need to learn more about
them. And it's, what's cool about that too is, you know, again, now that I'm leaving academia, especially in the United States... You know, when I get a grant, the university takes half.
Yes.
It just takes half right away.
Yes.
This money goes directly to the researchers' pockets and goes to buying equipment
and
paying
I'm doing a little bit of the homework for the listeners, and I'm only recommending ones that take minimal processing, you know, because of course they have to pay for their own equipment You know, a small, like 10%, and then the rest, like I think with AWF, something like 80% goes directly into the collars and the local community.
Yeah, the people that are doing it. The one that I found, and you're right, peer review, this is where I found this one, was an article, a scientific article on the effects of engaging the local populace. And this was for snow leopards, because I was aware of this program previously, and it's through the Snow Leopard Trust.
Yes, that's a great one. That was my backup.
Yeah, they're working with people in Nepal, Mongolia, where there's a lot of conflicts with snow leopards, you know, preying on their herds.
The livestock,
Right, and it's interesting because Nepal, the Buddhists, they don't believe in killing them, but they allow like soldiers to come in and hunt them and other people. So they don't really care.
They do work around.
Please, up there, go kill them. In Mongolia, they shoot them. You know, they do, because there's conflicts. So through incentive programs, they have developed good livestock insurance, which I know in Africa they're trying to do too with some of the predators. But depending on the government, that's very complex because the government usually takes the money. Some have. Others, you know, they're not getting to the people. The money's not getting to the people.
Or the animals.
So this study actually looked at the effects, and it had great effects, not only in Nepal, but in Mongolia, where the people are actually invested in the animals. Like in Mongolia, they sell their wool at a premium. And so I bought products that were part of the Snow Leopard Trust that they've shipped to the United States.
Very clever.
Yeah. So it's a good way. So that money's going directly back to those people in Mongolia and in different parts of the world. So that's definitely one you should Google and look at.
Yeah, it's just www.snowleopard.org.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so our calls for action this week is, please go to our email list. If you go on our website, you can subscribe to our email list and follow us, and you'll get an automatic email. Or you can go to Patreon and just follow us on Patreon. You don't necessarily have to be a paying member, but you can follow us on Patreon and you'll get a email that will let you know when we release new content, and then also updates and blog posts that Angie and I will be doing here in the new future. So you know, again, thank you for spending time with us. You've made it this far, so I think you might be hooked, but please give us feedback. We love it.
Yeah, the more feedback, the better. Absolutely. Yeah.
But thank you.
Thank you very much.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.